From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. From the very beginning of America's war on terror, a distinct storyline emerged of good and evil, of Bush the Bold versus the world's bad men. But is this a Hollywood epic or a new reality unfolding of American empire in the 21st century? Tonight On Point, heroes, villains, and the romance of empire. We begin, though, with the day's events in Iraq. Two American soldiers died today, one in an ambush in Baghdad, another in a traffic accident in Nasiriyah. And in Tikrit, U.S. forces dug up freshly buried weapons in a building belonging to Saddam Hussein's Fedayeen militia. Meanwhile, U.S. military officials have grown confident that Saddam Hussein's capture is imminent. Earlier, I spoke to John Diamond, Pentagon reporter for USA Today. I asked him if the latest Army statement that the noose is tightening for Saddam Hussein is based in fact or is simply a rhetorical flourish.
As we've seen with so many things relating to Iraq, there's disagreement within the U.S. government about this. Intelligence officials are not necessarily endorsing that view. Intelligence officials that I talk to here in Washington are questioning the notion that U.S. raiders came within 24 hours of Saddam, for example, at a neighborhood in Baghdad in a raid in the last 24 hours. There's some certainty that he is in Iraq and probably the northern half of the country. There's a feeling that his entourage is very small and therefore his ability to defend and protect himself is shrinking. There's a feeling that he is probably in disguise physically. So his assets for self-protection are shrinking. The loss of his sons means that there's that much less to be terrified about in terms of passing on information about Saddam. So there's optimism, but there's disagreement about just how close the U.S. forces are coming right now.
So these are just feelings at the moment, a sense that the noose is tightening rather than any specific intelligence as to his whereabouts.
There's no doubt that there's an increase in volume of tips. However, only a small percentage of the tips pan out into anything. So the job right now is a sifting operation of intelligence collectors in Iraq, wading through a large amount of information, trying to find out which leads to pursue. There's no question, and it is demonstrable, that there's an increase in the number of tips coming in. We're told that the quality of these tips appears to be better, but we can't measure that until the man is caught or killed.
And what explains the greater willingness, it seems, of Iraqis to come forward with intelligence as to the possible whereabouts of Saddam Hussein?
The absence of any notion that Saddam himself is directing operations, in other words, his inability to engage in leadership other than the occasional tape that comes out, plus the death of his two sons now means that there is no one really to be afraid of if you turn Saddam in, because the two sons might have been thought of as enforcers who could go after people who provide information to the Americans. That fear is now eliminated.
So the closer they get to him, the more willing Iraqis are to come forward with information about him.
That appears to be the case. That is what we're hearing, particularly from the U.S. military, and U.S. intelligence does endorse the idea that there is more information coming forward. But it's difficult to gauge right now. There seems to be a wait-and-see attitude in some quarters in Iraq, a desire not to be seen too publicly to be cooperating with the American forces. And with a figure like Saddam, who has been such a survivor for so long against tremendous enmity and adversity, there's no certainty until his corpse is on television.
So if Saddam Hussein is more and more unable to mount a resistance because he's too busy, in the words of one U.S. officer, trying to save his own skin, how come then the attacks go on?
This would clearly indicate that the attacks are separate and apart from the regime itself, that they are a combination of hardcore elements of the Ba'athist Party, which even with or without Saddam was going to do badly under the U.S. occupation, and also foreign elements who are, you might say, opportunistic participants in what's going on because they see some perhaps political gain to their various Islamic causes by coming in as soldiers of fortune to fight against the U.S. force presence in Iraq.
And is this in any way affecting U.S. military strategy in Iraq, the fact that they might now be dealing with a different kind of enemy?
Yes, we're starting to get the first estimates of the size of the force, for example, that they're up against in the range of 5,000. The Americans have decided on an aggressive strategy that you might call a latter-day version of search and destroy. Rather than wait and garrison and protect, they're going out into the field looking for the guerrilla fighters. This is a kind of strategy which in the short term may provide increased opportunities for Iraqi fighters and foreign fighters to inflict casualties, but the idea is that it will shorten the overall conflict and therefore shorten the overall casualty list.
And in the short term, the U.S. military are prepared to take those casualties?
It appears to be the case. The attitude at this point is that a huge investment has been made in defeating Saddam Hussein's regime, and that to back out of the country because of a not inconsiderable level of casualties, not high casualties on the scale of, say, a full-scale war, but still one or two a day, and we've had two today, there seems to be a feeling that the United States has made a huge investment and needs to stay the course. This is a line coming both from Democrats and Republicans in Washington. Even among those who did not support the war, there's sort of a no-turning-back-now attitude.
John Diamond, thank you.
You're very welcome.
That was John Diamond, Pentagon reporter for USA Today. He spoke to us from Washington. The terrorist attacks on 9/11 gave birth to the creation of a new American empire, the story of which, according to one interpretation, reads like an epic. A story of good versus evil, a real-life action movie of wars waged for retribution, of the all-American heroes vanquishing the terrorist villains in Afghanistan, Iraq, and around the globe. But is this an accurate portrait of America's war on terror, or is it a romantic view of American empire? Do you buy the Bush administration's casting of the story of Bush the Bold, of Saddam the Bad, a political storytelling oversimplifying the truth? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining me now from New York is Thomas Zongatita, contributing editor to Harper's Magazine and author of The Romance of Empire and the Politics of Self-Love. In the July issue of the magazine, he teaches at New York University and is the author of the forthcoming book, Medicated. Thanks for being with us, Thomas.
Thank you. The book's called Mediated, Mr. Marshall.
I do beg your pardon.
That's right.
I do beg your pardon.
Although there's a certain overlap in the meaning.
Well, relates to your culture as anesthetic, perhaps.
That's right.
That is what I was thinking of. But anyway, the romance of empire, what exactly do you mean by that phrase?
Well, it's actually, if you see, look at some of the paragraphs of the essay, I mean it quite literally in the old-fashioned capital R sense, romanticism, a united polity, embodied in a leader, a sense of common purpose, of fusion, of being together, that intense form of patriotism or nationalism we associate with, you know, the Marseillaise played at high points during the beginnings of nationalism. So I think there's a certain strata of feeling going on, being incited and re-incited by these events that make that term literally applicable.
And is this a construct of the Bush administration?
I don't think they're I'd like to just formally, sort of as we start the conversation, disassociate myself from the view of this as, you know, it's all a movie, it's all a video game. The two soldiers who in your news report today who died, and all the Iraqi civilians who are dying every day are dying. And I saw the World Trade Center hit, and I was in New York when it came down, and I smelled the smells in the air. So there's a parameter around the whole kind of issue of storyline and narrative and action revenge movie and so on. There's a parameter of reality around it. And I don't want anyone to think that I'm arguing that there isn't and that I don't take it seriously. That's very important for me to have understood. But nevertheless, within that parameter, I think, largely because of the ubiquity and the high quality and the enormous volume of mediation, of media, of representation that has emerged in the last 10, 20 years, and that concentrates itself around any event, O.J. Simpson, Monica Lewinsky, and now this, that there's a certain way in which real events become stories or scripts that people improvise their way through.
Give us some examples of that.
Well, all right, I will. Actually, when I heard you from the BBC, this example, which I haven't written about for a long time, popped back in my mind, and you could really be in a better position to say whether this is true or not. My very strong feeling as I watched the aftermath of the death of Princess Di, particularly the mourners and the activities of the mourners, especially stacking up the flowers in front of Buckingham Palace in a sort of virtual, they were like cannon, batteries of flowers, sort of virtual revolution, insisting that the Queen come out and do a Jerry Springer for us and tell us how she felt, you know, and so on. I'd ask all the listeners, I'd ask myself, were the people mourning her in their millions in the streets? I'm sure their grief was real, but I get the very strong feeling that it was also a performance of some sort, and that they were playing a role in a public event that was extremely reflexive and was reflected back to them immediately as the story unfolded. They even gained a certain amount of control of the script. I mean, the Queen did finally emerge to say something, as I recall.
But looking back to the public mourning for the death of Princess Diana, arguably that was very spontaneous. But I think that you're suggesting in your essay a certain manipulation, a certain deliberate use of props.
There's no question about it. And we see that, for example, in the case of the aircraft carrier landing. That's the clearest example of that. That is going on. At the same time, there are slightly more spontaneous things going on that are also very potent, as, for example, the way Bush flung his arm around the fireman on top of the pile of rubble down at the World Trade Center. I'm not sure if that was planned or not planned. There are, I think, people involved in these things. I'll give you another example. I'll give you an example from the World Trade Center. I spent a great deal of time around the site. I spent a lot of time talking to people who were going in down there, they called it. They didn't call it Ground Zero. I spent a lot of time talking to people who couldn't get down there because they didn't have skills. That's a big part of the romance of empire in the essay, in the Harper's essay, is the way the role of gear and the way gear makes men feel. There's no doubt in my mind as I watched through that week that everyone was rising to this occasion in a sincere way to try to help, but that they also saw themselves, because of the coverage they were getting as they were doing what they were doing, they saw themselves as not exactly actors, that wouldn't be quite right, but something approaching that. That some new hybrid of public life is what I'm after, and I don't quite have the words for it because it's, I really think this is relatively recent. So there's manipulation going on. I wouldn't deny it for a minute. But I think the phenomenon is much deeper than that. This isn't just image versus reality. It's some kind of a fusion of the two.
Okay, well, let's pursue that a little further in a moment. Thomas Zengotita. We're talking tonight about the romance of empire as the Bush administration telling an epic story of good versus evil with Americans, the captive audience. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the romance of empire and the story being told by the Bush administration. Do you feel you're in the midst of a real-life action movie? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're talking to Thomas DeZenga-Tita, contributing editor to Harper's Magazine and author of The Romance of Empire and the Politics of Self-Love, in the July issue of the magazine. Mr. Zdenga-Tita, is this romance of empire also an oversimplification of the story?
Oh, completely, without question. And to this degree, the sort of classic progressive left analysis of coverage of this is as valid now as it ever was. I mean, there's no possible way that these representations can be adequate. And of course, in that inadequacy, that's where the spin and the manipulation comes in. It definitely comes in. I think one thing that's interesting about that, though, Mr. Marshall, is I think people are much more aware of that. And by people, I mean more or less everybody who pays attention to current events in the United States. And it's important to remember that's only half the population. That's really very important to remember. But among people who really do follow things, I think they understand about spin and manipulation. I'd go even further. I think they probably participate in spin and manipulation. Actually, here's a guess. Here's a hypothesis. I'd be fascinated to know if any of your callers have any information on this. I bet that a substantial number of people who answer poll questions about major political events think about their answers not in terms of what they might actually believe, but in terms of the agenda that they understand will be served by whatever answer they give. And that they do this in as smooth and sophisticated a way as the regular talking heads on the, you know, on the pundit shows. That's a guess, but I wouldn't be surprised. And if that's true, it's another example of this kind of fusion of reality and representation, the performance and actual living that might be going on. Let me give you if you don't mind.
No, please do go ahead.
Okay. Let me give you another example of how Bush the Bold is playing his role, or has up until now. The storyline they're promoting, this good against evil storyline they're promoting, is starting to fray at the edges. I mean, the weapons of mass destruction could be his Monica Lewinsky moment, you know, if they're not found. Certainly, all the spinners on the left, on the left are trying to, you know, shift the script by playing that way. And I think everyone listening, the whole audience out there understands this. I don't think anybody's taken in anymore. This is a very important piece of it. I think they play with it. Anyway, Bush is cast quite accidentally, but ideally as the leader for this enterprise, precisely because of the way in which he authentically and truthfully, this is not a manipulation on his part, in other words, he authentically, deep in his heart, doesn't trust anything intellectual, has always been suspicious of learning, of educated people, of refinements of any kind. All of those sorts of things seem to him to be fundamentally phony. And he sees his kind of simplicity, his emotional, heartfelt sympathies for ordinary people going about their ordinary lives. I mean, he really believes this about himself. He really thinks that, East Coast intellectuals are phonies who hate America because they're guilt-tripping themselves to death, and that's crazy and perverse, and that he and the constituency he represents have better things to do than to read fancy books and pore over the history of, you know, the role that the European colonial powers played in the Middle East. I mean, that's completely the phrase "nothing could justify what they did on 9/11" play, which became the rallying cry of the Bush constituency when they were trying to organize this revenge movie narrative. And, you know, it was designed to cut off contextualized accounts that people were trying to give that wouldn't excuse 9/11 but would somehow explain the history of the incredibly complicated history of the West and the Arab Arab world.
Okay.
And you say nothing could justify what they did on 9/11. And then you're all forgiven. Bush is forgiven. And everybody who Bush represents is forgiven for their complete ignorance, their willful ignorance of the country's history and the history of these other peoples and nations. And this is something that Bush embodies truthfully. This isn't a manipulation. He really does reflect the willful ignorance of his constituents.
Okay, Thomas, you wanted to hear from some callers. We have a number up at the moment. Let's go firstly to Imran. He's calling from Ashland, Massachusetts. Imran, what did you want to say?
I thought it was going to be Texas there for a minute. Okay. Yeah.
Imran, good evening to you. Thanks for coming on the program. What did you want to say?
Well, you know, in thinking about, you know, romance and empire, to me it seems like what this has been boiled down to is like empire of civilization versus kind of the barbarians. And, you know, we're the good civilization, the good empire. The Middle East is the bad. And it kind of harkens back to this idea that it's our responsibility to Christianize the heathen. And you know, people might say, well, that's far-fetched. But then when you look at what the response is domestically, you have, you know, George Bush, who is you know, a born-again Christian, but it's the alignment of the Christian right and the policies of their view towards the Middle East, and in particular Israel, and how it lines up with his views as a Christian. And then the whole thing kind of gets wrapped up into this empire, and that we're out there to try to convert the Middle East into some sort of shade of ourselves so that we could feel good about it. And I kind of contrast that with the recent trip to Africa, and, you know, Bush is kind of like weepy-eyed and happy to be there, and he wants to do something for these people, certainly not militarily to change them, but more on the compassionate side. And it almost looks like, I know this might sound cynical, but it almost sounds like it's an opportunity to kind of, Africa is like is an opportunity to kind of reintroduce this, you know, Christianization of the continent. And I think the wars, much of the civil wars in the Sudan have been portrayed as a, you know, Christian versus Islamic war, when in my mind it's really more of a tribal issue. The whole thing kind of wraps up into this empire of faith almost, you know, where it's Christianity versus the barbarians.
But you've kind of outlined, if you like, the ideological framework to the argument, but are you very conscious of this romance of empire that Thomas Dzengatita has been talking about?
You know, I don't think so, for the simple reason that, you know, certainly Britain and France, I mean, there was a certain amount of romance towards empire, and I think that came along with this idea of enlightenment, you know, kind of doing things to improve the lot of the rest of the world who hasn't benefited from, you know, from Europe's enlightenment. In America, it seems like it kind of bypassed all of that. And I think the average American has no experience of empire because, you know, it itself was kind of a breakaway colonial and really wanted to try to distance itself from the idea of kingship. And so I don't think in America this idea of romance with empire really resonates. I think, if anything, I think it's resonating more along the lines of secularism versus religiosity, where you have an administration that adheres to religiosity. And I think maybe the left in this country, or the moderates, if you want to call them that, tend to adhere more to a secular, you know, pluralistic view of the world.
Thomas Dzengatita?
Yeah, he said so many things. I'm frantically scribbling notes. I think he's right about the secular religious division at home in the United States. I think he's mistaken, probably because he himself doesn't feel the surging, rising, kind of thrusting sort of nationalistic identificational feelings that a great many people have felt in the aftermath of 9/11. And, of course, it's not everybody, but it's the constituency that really sees this war on terror and the Battle of Iraq, which they're so careful to call it the Battle of Iraq, so that we'll understand that this war is going to go on indefinitely. And, you know, as a romantic enterprise, I'm not saying everyone's swept up in it, but some are.
Can I just go back, though, to a point that you made earlier, which is that the conviction that President Bush has in his beliefs, how do you square that, then, with the suggestion that there is also manipulation going on?
It's an extraordinary thing. I really do think I can square it, however. I think in Bush's mind, it's a matter of hardball. I mean, one thing he prides himself on, in addition to his simple heart and his sentimental compassion and so on, one thing he prides himself on, and this is why, if you look back at the essay, which I hope people will read because a lot of it's in the style, not really, I can't discursively reproduce it. This goes back to, the action movie scenario depends on the hero suffering some horrible injustice at the hands of some incredibly bad person. I mean, think Steven Seagal movies, Vin Diesel, the old Clint Eastwood movies. There has to be something awful happen to this good hero at the beginning, and it has to be so awful that it will justify everything that he does subsequently in the name of retribution. So one of the main points of the essay is that the sentimentality about self and about me and mine and us, this tearful emotion about ourselves, is a necessary psycho-moral premise upon which you can launch this other side, this gloating, you know, bring 'em on, you know, that side of Bush. So reconciling the manipulations with the sincerely felt emotions is the same thing as reconciling him saying, bring them on, you know, we'll nail them to the door, you know, that kind of talk. It's the same thing as reconciling that with his teary eyes in Africa, although I missed the teary eyes in Africa, actually. I thought he was surfing through the place so fast he didn't have time for teary eyes. But okay, I've seen the teary eyes many times.
Okay, let's bring in Abu Hassan. He's calling from Milwaukee in Wisconsin. Abu Hassan, what do you want to say?
Well, I think it's a very concise and right to the point impression, the idea of the nostalgia of an emperor, or it's basically epitomize the reality of what the United States is for as imperialistic country right now. But I have two questions. I would like to ask your guest, please, about the idea of Khilafah. As Muslims now, is Pakistan, Egypt, Jordan, they are all yearning to reestablish their one big entity, which is called Khilafah, which is the Universal Islamic State. This is not much talked about, but it is a grassroots movement that is growing deeply and fast across the globe. And based on the preemptive intervention or strike, I think the United States has read that the Khilafah is inevitable. It is coming. The boundaries among the Muslims is going to burn down, and we have to be present there militarily to prevent that, or if you will, preemptively abort that process from taking place. And they are willing to go against all type of false allegations to justify their presence.
Okay, Abu Hassan, let's get a response to that from Thomas de Zengotita. Have you given much attention to the expansion of the Islamic Empire?
I'm embarrassed to admit that this is the first time I've ever heard of that term, Khilafah, if I'm even getting it right now. I take refuge in the fact that I'm not a sort of nuts and bolts policy type of writer. I'm more, you know, the culture and the psychology of things. But what he just described would be, as a dialectical consequence of the way this, one possible way this could go, if I understood him correctly, is, terrifying.
But, I mean, what you're basically saying presupposes that what America is doing in terms of an expansion of an empire, trying to romanticize that, is a bad thing.
Yes, but there's going to be, and I'm not associating myself with this, but the what's going to emerge, assuming we don't, if we have another major or two more major terrorist incidents in the United States. I can't even the mind boggles thinking what the consequences of that will be. But assuming that doesn't happen, what's going to emerge, it's already emerging, is an alternative view of American interventionism abroad, an alternative to Bush's sort of Christianized, self-righteous, simple, know-nothing view. There'll be a liberal imperialism or a liberal interventionism. Michael Ignatieff, Paul Berman, these voices are already out there. Christopher Hitchens, sort of switched sides on this. And so there's those people are all looking at Islam in a scary way, too. Not as scary as Bush, but there's big problems for an Enlightenment-inspired, secular, liberal approach to coping with all of this. All I have to do is mention women's rights, you can see how tangled and difficult it becomes. So it's not the Bush notion of empire isn't the only storyline under which America could see itself as obliged or that it should, start to play this presiding role in the world. I don't think empire is going to necessarily be the right word for that. It's some new formation. When I use the word empire in the essay, again, this is a satirical kind of analysis of one mood of the country that Bush and his constituents represent. The actual situation is much more complicated, and the way it's going to play out, I'm not even sure empire.
But you do see the United States at the moment, to quote from your essay, I think, intoxicated with images of the country's own might at the moment, overt, unabashed, and raw.
It was certainly intoxicated up to the moment, and including the moment when they staged the fall of Saddam's statue, one of the major uncovered stories in the mainstream media here in the United States. Talk about a mixture of real and staged. But since then, things are fraying. Things are fraying. There's the possibility. This is why all the Democratic candidates are, or at least now, Lieberman represents the sort of liberal interventionism. He'll be a sort of liberal imperialist, whatever that's going to mean in the future. But others who, even the ones who supported the intervention originally, are, trying to find a way to turn the storyline now. So the intoxication is wearing off for the moment.
Thomas de Zengertide, stay with us. Thomas de Zengertide, editor or contributing editor to Harper's Magazine and author of The Romance of Empire and the Politics of Self-Love in the July issue of the magazine. Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about The Romance of Empire this hour. How do you see the story of American empire unfolding? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're talking to Thomas de Zengertide, contributing editor to Harper's Magazine and author of The Romance of Empire and the Politics of Self-Love in the July issue of the magazine. But let's go to Richard. He's calling from Providence, Rhode Island. And Richard, you want to have to say something about the role of the media in the creation of this empire?
Yes, thanks for giving me a chance to speak. Well, I think that there's actually a twin mediaization, both East and West, as both Eastern and Western powers or forces or empires or civilizations are struggling to find the ideology which justifies either their preemption on one hand or resistance on the other. And so that this process is increasingly polarizing both, whether we see the evil empire or the axis of evil or on the Western side, or kafir and shaitan or devilish people on the Eastern side. And in fact, it seems that we have an empire on the ascendancy with the standard stuff for empires, barbarians at the gates, demonization of and xenophobia of the enemy on both sides. Of course, there are all the other political, economic, and military issues about, you know, overextension and moral corruption at the core of East and West. So I guess my comment is to just certainly agree with the central speakers that there is this new dramatic play with horrendous and bloody results, but it is a dialectical dance of two forces. So those are some of the thoughts I wanted to share.
Thomas de Sangatita.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think that's extremely important thing to say, and a more extended analysis, which we don't have time for, would be to, you know, to look at the way the role the way the mass media plays into cultures and societies which haven't moved through three centuries of industrialization and secularization. It'll be a very different kind of dynamic, but it'll still be as ubiquitous and pervasive and as powerful there as it is here. And you just have to, what people really have to stop and realize, it's something that's so obvious that people forget it, is that these images are so powerful and the core production values, put it that way, are so high that their capacity to kind of burrow into people's psyches and constitute a semi-reality for them, you just can't underestimate what an important development that is compared to, say, the days in which everyone got their understanding of the outside world that they weren't immediately acquainted with.
But do you see the media collaborating, albeit unwittingly, in the current narrative?
Both wittingly and unwittingly, and I could sort of make that the motto of my argument. It's both. They do it quite wittingly to exploit every possible attention-getting moment they could possibly have. Today was Bob Hope Day. He died. Iraq might as well not exist. So wittingly, they'll collaborate with anything to get the sticky eyeballs on the screen. But unwittingly, they set up conditions and situations and narrative lines. Your producer this morning was talking to me about how she felt watching reporters on the decks of aircraft carriers interview pilots coming in from their bombing raids over Iraq during the first weeks of the war. And she noticed how the interviews were being conducted and that both the pilots and the interviewer fell automatically into the format of the sports interviewer, you know, grabbing the player after the game or after the match and getting the few words from the player who would say some general thing about, well, I got out there and I had to focus. You know, the pilots talk just like the athletes do, kind of glancing around half bored, and the reporters were leaning in with the mics knowing that they weren't going to get much of an answer. You know, so that's unwitting. That's unwitting. But it's very potent.
Let's bring in Mark. He's calling from Oshkosh, Wisconsin. Good evening to you, Mark.
Good evening, gentlemen.
Now, you'd like to say that there are those in Washington who confuse romance with the reality of war.
That is absolutely true. I've been studying the neoconservative movement to some degree, and their sworn goal is to dominate politics in this country and to dominate politics throughout the world by projecting American military power. And the people who are running this operation in Washington, the Bush administration, with the exception of Colin Powell, none of them has any military experience.
Yeah.
George Bush is a draft dodger who spent his entire term in the Air National Guard AWOL, and these guys are sending people out to be killed without a clue as to what the consequences of their actions are. And the worst part about it is that they love to cloak themselves in the mantle of Christianity, and they forget that one of those commandments that came down from the mountain was, thou shalt not bear false witness, and another one was, thou shalt not kill. And they have sacrificed the basic tenet of philosophy and religion that the end can never justify the means, and if you use corrupt means, you corrupt the end in the process.
Thomas?
Yes, let me react. I'm so glad somebody brought up the neoconservatives. I was going to jam it in there myself if someone didn't. However, just the last part of what the gentleman said, everything he said up to then was I completely agree with. But the last part about Christianity, that most of the neoconservatives, the ones in, with real power, the Straussians coming out of the University of Chicago, and they are not Christians and they're not particularly religious. This is a highly secular, almost classical Greek, you know, Western rationality vision that they're serving. And that's one of the reasons that you can't look, because they really are the long-range thinkers behind this. Bush is a convenience for them, they're not serving Christ. They're serving Platonic rationality, and it's as the highest expression of human nature, and they mean that very sincerely, and they think the big Western reason is the world's salvation.
Can I just ask you, though, I think I'm right in saying that central to your thesis is the grievance that the current administration feels over 9/11 and the way in which their reaction to that is now driving this narrative of the romance of empire. What if 9/11 hadn't happened?
That would have been Bush when Bush came into power saying, you know, he's not for nation building. Right. And I think he meant that. That fits perfectly with the rest of his character. You know, he has no interests in. It's interesting. The man has no hobby. He has no interests. If 9/11 hadn't happened or something comparable, I think the neoconservatives in his administration would have, had an entirely different, lived in an entirely different world. It would have been a very frustrating place for them.
So we wouldn't have had any of what is unfolding now.
I don't think so. Again, I'm not going to pass myself off as a policy expert. I have friends who know these things much better than I do, and one of them is probably going to call me up as soon as I get off the air and give me an earful. But I don't think so. I don't think so.
Jane's calling from Needham in Massachusetts. Good evening to you, Jane.
Hello. Good evening. Very interesting discussion. I wanted to make several comments. The first one is that I think that the narrative here is really what one could call U.S. President Cowboy 2, Reagan having been Cowboy 1.
Yes, yes.
And really, I think this is sort of a front discourse PR thing that he plays out. And similarly, you know, there are all sorts of eminence grise behind the throne that are really calling the shots in terms of sort of long-term strategic interests that might be in play. It seems to me that, you know, in the Afghanistan, then followed by Iraq, it's not the short-term oil interests, but the long-term ones, pipelines through Afghanistan, how they hook up with others through Iraq and that whole scene, along with Iraq being probably the only country that had the potential for a secular population because it was not totally drenched in fundamentalism. And this is all very interesting when you, I mean, that's, and then the parenthesis here is that Bush maybe is a fundamentalist and is playing that script. However, he doesn't come from a fundamentalist family. He comes from a very sophisticated East Coast WASP family. So whatever he's denying about his own background is probably lurking under the surface in all kinds of nefarious ways that we don't even know.
But Thomas DeSengotita, you would argue that President Bush has very deliberately brought into the culture of Texas.
Yes, and deliberately and precisely because he was such a failure in all the settings on the East Coast in which his father was such an enormous success. He was, in effect, turning his back on a setting in which he wasn't really comfortable and didn't really succeed. And that's one of the reasons his swaggering mannerisms don't look quite convincing. He looks like a boy kind of pretending to be tougher than he is and so on, because he's still learning how to act like that. I agree with everything the lady just said, the very perceptive remarks, except the front-end propaganda part. Yes, there are these eminences behind the throne manipulating things as furiously as they can in the service of the long-range strategic interests of American hegemony as they see it. I think what they're really thinking about is China in 2030. I think they're trying to set the United States in control of the world's oil supplies and into as a hedge against the emergence of China as a possible real competitor. I think that's what they're thinking. I don't think Bush is thinking. Well, I'm sure that Bush is, they've shared that vision with Bush, and he's bought into it. But I think the ladies overestimating Bush's calculations and underestimating his authenticity. And I'd say the same for about Ronald Reagan. I mean, she's so right about Reagan. Bush is the heir of Reagan, not the heir of his father. Not just in the content of his politics, but in his persona.
Okay, we just got time to hear from Bobby. He's calling from Natick, Massachusetts. Bobby, what did you want to say?
Actually, it's Bobby Shee, Julian.
I do beg your pardon.
That's all right. I wanted to just, I'll try to make it fast because I know you're at the end, and have the guest comment on relating what's going on now to a book that lots of people were reading in the 60s and 70s by Eric Hofer, The True Believer. That a lot of people who maybe feel like they have very small lives and never get to be part of something important, we all kind of latch on to some cause. Because if you really have a concern for human rights or suffering or terrorism or injustice or any of these things, there are people, you know, born in suffering, live in suffering, die in suffering, had nothing to do with what happened on 9/11. And, of course, it was a very horrendous day. You can't take away from how awful it was. But the Globe did a wonderful article on, you know, 8-9 million people a year die of preventable causes. So I was just interested in what the guest feels is how people continue to be so wrapped up in this one particular horror as it was, when there's many, many, many other things that don't get in the headlines and aren't sensational, and if maybe it has something to do with that, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Bobby, many thanks for that. Thomas, an answer.
Oh, absolutely. She's nailed it. That's exactly right. I mean, and I think the essay makes that clear. People feel elevated out of the doldrums of their ordinary everyday existences by great events like this. And I think that's probably always been the case at the onset of war, certainly the beginning of World War One, the Civil War. I mean, this is something deep in the psychology, quite apart from the new media the last 30 years. I think it's just more, it's actually very complicated. We're at the end of the show, but the new media make a big difference in the way in which this rising out of anonymity into historical significance, which is so much a part of nationalism under circumstances like this.
Okay, Thomas, look, many, many thanks for that.
My pleasure.
Thomas DeZengotita, contributing editor to Harper's Magazine and author of The Romance of Empire and the Politics of Self-Love in the July issue of the magazine. Continue the conversation on our website. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.